Paula, thank you and good afternoon, everyone. It's an absolute pleasure and delight to be invited back, and same with the panel as well. Good to see you all again. And Sarah Jane, you weren't here with us last year, so welcome back. We've got a lot to cover and in very little time, so we're going to probably zip around, raise plenty of issues that are currently local and live, things that are of global significance. And obviously, with politics, there's a state election just over a year away, and certainly there's plenty happening at the federal scene. But we're going to start with some breaking news, or a news story that has happened today and is quite significant. And Gareth, you've talked about it a lot on your program today. I don't know if you've all caught up with the news, but Ben Wyatt has announced today that he won't be recontesting the next election. I think what I've seen on social media is Ben's been described by nearly everyone on both sides as one of the good guys. Gareth, what's your insights as to what's happening with this big story today, which has significant political ramifications, I think?
David, I thought you were going to ask me about Tony Sage and Perth Glory and the London Football Exchange, but perhaps we'll come to that later.
Paul, no, I think give us more time.
I think that, it is a surprise to me. It certainly came as a shock. The alert went out this morning that there'd be a press conference at 9:30, and the Premier's office very tightly held about what it was about. So Ben is, I think, a generational talent in politics in this state. I think it is a shame for Ben and a shame for the state that he'll never be Premier. If he had have played his cards a little bit differently back in 2011, then perhaps, who knows? Who knows if that would have happened, excuse me. But Ben is one of these guys who, there's no one who really has bad things to say about him. He hasn't made any enemies. He's, I think, widely respected on both sides of the political aisle. He is a very normal sort of guy. He's a loving dad, a loving husband, and whilst I haven't had the chance to talk to him, I was on air when his press conference was happening. My sense is that perhaps he's just lost the love a little bit, which is understandable. He's done a long spell in opposition and now some pretty hard work in government. I think that if he's not the most talented member of the McGowan ministry, then he's certainly in the top two. And I think from that point of view, it will be a big challenge for the government to replace him. Minds will turn to who will be the next treasurer. I would think off the top of my head that Rita Saffiotti would be most likely, but that will obviously be a matter for Mark McGowan in due course, and there's plenty of time for that to resolve itself.
I want to sort of jump in there, and there's certainly lots of political commentary, but I think we sort of jump tracks a little. I think this says a lot about politics as a profession and the impact it has on families. Ben has two young children. Politics, as we've seen federally and state, consumes a lot of people's time, energy. I think it's becoming increasingly vicious as a profession. Social media plays a part in that. Gemma, I know we've had a short conversation. Does this indicate that the job, the profession of politics is becoming less appealing and harder on those that want to enter into it?
You just said a really interesting word. You said the profession of politics, and I think that's the problem.
I'm being too kind.
No, don't think you're being too... No, I don't think you're being too kind. I think perhaps ideologically I like to think of politics as a vocation, because it should be a vocation. I was lucky enough to spend a bit of time with Sir Charles Court before he passed away, and man, the man can talk. But in terms of talking about politics as a public service, and I referenced a conversation I'd had with a couple of other members of parliament. I mean, I'm not being completely Pollyanna about it. Some people go in because they see it as a profession, like teaching is a profession or law is a profession. My view is that, you couldn't pay me enough to be in politics. Greatest of respect to our MPs in the room, and I genuinely mean that. You could not drag me, chuck money at me from a million miles away, I wouldn't do it. For many of the reasons that you've just alluded to, the pressures, all of that kind of stuff. But I do believe that there has been somewhat of a debasing of the political environment. A lot of talk about statesmanship, lack of statesmanship, when point scoring and ideology overcomes pragmatism. I wrote a column for The Australian about a month ago about finding political ground. I mean, I had the temerity to agree with Tanya Plibersek on a particular issue when she talked about, that thing about
The
Americans. Yeah. Because my dad came to Australia on a boat. Her parents were migrants. We found common ground. And to me, that's not shouldn't be the exception, but it's become the exception. And when the environment in which our politicians are operating is all about conflict and toxicity, what on earth do you expect?
Sarah Jane, you've recently returned back to Perth after a stint on the East Coast, so you've seen state and federal. Do you have any thoughts on the challenges that politicians with families, the impact that it has, and is it sustainable?
Is it sustainable is a very interesting question, and I think to the point that these two guys raised as well, that is a very different game today. Mm. You're on 24/7. Mm. I mean, there is no switch off, there is downtime, there is no family time, so you have to really want it, and it is a massive commitment. And unfortunately, your family time does, become second to this political life. And for many people, it isn't a life that they want to continue after having done it for so long.
Mm. And what about the media cycle in all of this? Does, each of you are either current or past media professionals?
Well, it's not going to slow down, David. So yeah. I think it's almost, it is what it is.
But you
so
also
move
get
on
what you tolerate, I think.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that the media cycle is the reason that, that Ben's decided to step away. I think he's had a pretty good go at it and he's ready to try something else with his life. His contemporaries are making a lot more money than him in doing whatever it is they're doing, the people that he went to university with and so on. He has made a fantastic contribution to this state and I think he's entitled to call it when he wants to call it. He has done, and I'm sure in the previous sessions I wasn't able to sit in on, you've heard information about the repair of the state budget, and there's a debate about whether that might have gone too far, about whether it's now time to loosen the purse strings. Mm. But he had a hell of a job in front of him. He's done it brilliantly. And I think that I'll say this about Ben and the timing of his departure. I just wish he had had a little bit more time to be a champion for and a role model for the reconciliation story. Because I think he just scratched the surface on that. Mm. And I actually would not be surprised if that is where he goes next. I haven't had any conversations with him about it. But I think that he, as someone who can bridge relations between Aboriginal Australia and non-Aboriginal Australia, is just about the best that I've ever seen at it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you can probably tell I'm an admirer. I'm a fan.
Yeah. I think there's lots of many of us, if not all of us, are
correct
admirers of Ben. So we wish him all the best. I did say we're going to jump around a lot. So here we go. We're going to jump again. So the federal scene. I think it's fair to say it's probably a summer the Prime Minister and the government would rather forget. Sarah Jane, has it been as bad as I'm making out? We've had the hashtag Scotty from marketing come out, the bushfires, Hawaii holidays with his families, not with that we should begrudge politicians the chance to have holidays with their families, particularly after what we just spoke about. How bad has it been and is it recoverable? Is it irreparable? What's going on?
Look, I think it's already recovering, to be honest, and I think it depends where you're getting this information from. I think if you're caught up in the social media vote and those hashtags, you'd think it's terrible and it's not going to repair from that. But when I talk to my non-media and political family and friends, it doesn't really register with them and they're not that concerned about it. They're much more concerned about other issues, such as paying their bills. Like, they're not concerned about whether the Prime Minister was on holidays during the bushfire crisis.
Yep. GT, the echo chamber of social media.
As someone who doesn't mind tweeting the odd picture of her dog, and I'm on...
Well, your dog has its own Twitter.
My dog has its own Twitter account. That's my achievement of the summer holidays. The truth is, it isn't real life, and if you think it's real life, we'd have a different government in Canberra right now. And not wanting to cast aspersions on my colleagues at the ABC, but every single person on the Insiders panel on Sunday predicted the wrong outcome because people, including in the media, are focusing on the wrong conversations on the wrong platforms. Did the Prime Minister make mistakes? Yes, he did. And my putting my day-to-day job hat on in terms of the comms role that I have, the problem with the holiday in Hawaii wasn't the problem the holiday in Hawaii. It was the fact that he made it a secret. All he had to do was say, I'm a dad like everyone else. I need time with my family like everyone else. If it escalates, I'll come back. Mm. No story.
It's always a cover.
But it was... You said this to me years ago. You might not remember this, but you said to me, it's like finding Nemo when there's blood in the water. It's like the lie becomes worse than the original sin. It's true. Why was the Prime Minister needing a holiday a secret?
I think that the government was always going to have a honeymoon period which would then come to an end, and I think it came to an end more quickly than they had hoped, and certainly the mismanagement of the early stages of what these guys have just talked about was a part of it. Will there be lasting political damage to the government? I'll say this, I think there will be lasting impacts from the summer that we've just had, and I think from Western Australia it's difficult to appreciate just how traumatic the bushfire season in the eastern states has been. What I think is that the climate change discussion, which has become sort of two had to become two extreme camps firing rockets at each other over the head of the great mass of disengaged people in the middle has now become real for a lot of Australians. And I think you're starting to see that picked up with opinion polling. People are putting the environment up and up and up the list of their categories. It used to be a fourth or a fifth order issue. After hip pocket, jobs, economy, kids' education, good hospitals. It's starting, you're seeing it in the opinion research that tracks these things over time, to come up and up and up the ladder of priorities for voters. So I don't think, going forward, that there will be many more federal elections won by a political party that doesn't have something credible to say about the environment and climate change.
Sarah Jane?
Yeah, 100% agree. And particularly if I'm like, you know, talking to the business CEOs and the chairman I speak to, I mean, for them, a lot of surveys even related to business do talk about, you know, climate change and policy around that as their number one issue. And companies have moved ahead of government on that. I mean, most companies I speak to, they all have their own policies in place and they're just waiting for government to play catch up. And that is very much going to be a focus, I think, both state and federally, as both parties look towards the net zero emission policies and how that costs.
And I think in some circles, sort of on the right of the commentary, it's become fashionable to beat up big business and accuse them of being left-wing and woke. I see it slightly differently. I see it as them adjusting to the people that they know best, which is their customers.
Yep.
They're doing this because their customers believe it's important and it's in their business interest to do it. Peter Coleman at Woodside, I think, is sort of exhibit A for this when he talks about climate change being the defining issue for his business, and he's in the oil and gas business. Yep. He talks about it being important not just for whatever government policies are put around emissions that their projects create. It's also about actually attracting and retaining the most talented young Australians who he wants to work for his company.
But on to both of your points about climate change, agree for the record. And the issue is the cohort of people that you reference, the disenfranchised in the middle, who, to your earlier point, they're going, okay, well, I want to pay my bills, I want to send my kids to the school of my choice if I can, I want to take them on a holiday, maybe an overseas holiday every year. And you, if you are in that cohort, it doesn't have a particular investment one way or another, and you genuinely want to be part of the conversation, you are excluded. You're excluded by the far left and you're excluded by the far right. You're either too woke or too ignorant, or, you know, there's no place to engage the very people who need to be engaged, who will vote one way or another, in this conversation. And that's the stupidity of it.
And I think it's the challenge for political campaigns
as well. Okay, so exactly, this
week. Which is where good political campaigns need to find a broad base if they're going to engage people and win
votes.
Absolutely,
but moreover, explain it. It is not good enough for any politician, any company, no matter political bent, take that out of it for the minute, to say, this is our policy, this is how it's going to impact industry. We're not going to tell you how much it's going to cost, and we're not going to tell you what it's going to do to your job, and we're not going to tell you how we're going to get there. You just need to trust us. Tell me where that's going to work.
Leaves it very vulnerable to the
fear
campaign.
Look what happened federally last time, and I was genuinely surprised that this week Mr. Albanese said this is our 2050 target, but I'm not going to tell you how we're going to get there, and I'm not going to tell you how it's going to cost. I mean, have we learnt nothing? I, for one, am genuinely interested.
But the past decade has been the climate wars.
Sure, but it doesn't need
to be
war.
We haven't, on that issue, and if it's a real issue in the community, which I have every reason to believe that it is,
sure,
something has to change politically in the conversation and the policy conversation. What's that going
but
to
I
be?
But I think we're seeing that, though.
I think we are seeing that. And I get to your point about Albanese, but you'd have to assume that they are going to come out with the costings and how they're going to get their by-election.
You'd hope so.
Today.
You'd hope so.
And so I do feel that the conversation has definitely shifted and we are actually going to see policy that are going to force that change.
Yeah, I just feel like that was such an obvious own goal at the last federal election that you would not risk that again, even the perception of it. Because at the end of the day, there's a pitched battle between perception and reality, and that's at play in every sphere.
So let's watch that space. Sounds like the panel's predicting there will be a change of conversation on that, which I will wait and see. I'd like to think there will be, but a decade of behaviour is hard to change. Jumping now to state. We're 382 days until the next state election. I know Dean and Amber Jade don't need to be reminded of that, but it's going to be a big 12 months. I'll start with you, Gareth. Do you give Lisa Harvey and the Liberals any chance of victory?
Well, I want to synthesise something that David Gaynor said and something that the Governor said, which is that predictions are fraught.
I can still ask you the question.
That said, I don't give them zero chance. I think that would be foolish. Yeah. I think that the main issue is going to be the economy. And I think that the I'm a big believer in you can tell what political parties believe about what the public believes by how they act. And in the final third of last year, the McGowan government started acting like there was a domestic recession on. They started pumping lots of announcements, repackaging things, rebadging them things. There wasn't a press release that came out of the Premier's office that didn't have the word stimulus in it. The government that made its name on being fiscally responsible was all of a sudden making out-of-budget cycle spending announcements. We're trying to get the housing market going so that we can get construction jobs going. We're rebadging every school hall that gets fixed up as a stimulus package. Mm. This is a government for whom the penny has dropped that there's a real problem in the real economy. Now, I think that there is a disconnect in this town and in this state between boardrooms and between small business. And definitely. I talk to small business people 5 days a week from 9 till 12. Mm. They are hurting right across the board. Unless they happen to be directly exposed to mining, then they're starting to see things turn around and they're okay. But for every other sector of the economy, it is really, really tough out there, and I think that there has been belated recognition of that fact by the McGowan government. The start of this year, I'm sensing just a little bit that it was starting to turn. Even house prices, it's been a standard joke on my program, there's never been a better time to buy a house until next month. Yeah. You know, even that.
It's turned though.
Even that. You know, and how many times have we seen in the pages of the West Australian spruikers predicting the bottom of the market and it hasn't happened? So I'll finish for now on this thought. I was starting to detect that perhaps that was just starting to turn at the start of the year, because it's anecdote more than data, although there is a little bit of data there to support it, but you're starting to see big crowds turn up at home opens again. Mm. Rental vacancies are really low. Maybe there's a little bit more confidence in the housing market, which is indicating that perhaps that, you know, people are coming back to work in the state. Coronavirus, I think, is a big problem.
Yep.
And I think that represents a serious challenge, the dimensions of which I actually don't think have yet become clear, and I listened carefully to what our previous speakers said. Mm. I must say that I take a more pessimistic short-term and medium-term view of the economic impacts of the coronavirus situation than they do.
Sarah Jane, I'll bring you in on that. You're the business editor for Seven West.
Agree.
What's your read of the play?
Yeah, look, and obviously at the moment it's reporting season, so we're speaking to a lot of CEOs and chairmen who are giving outlook, and the number one question at the moment is the coronavirus and the impact. And a lot of them are saying, look, you know, the impact is this much if it's contained within the month, but if it's not contained within this month, it could go out to this much. And it really is an unknown. Like, every day we're getting updated figures on the impact. And you saw the Prime Minister come out today and the Federal Treasurer basically say, look, it's bigger than education and tourism. Mm. It goes into manufacturing, building. Yeah. And in fact, they're now obviously setting the scene for not hitting a surplus in the federal budget this year. Mm. And they're putting it on the back of the virus and saying it's worse than the bushfire impact. And I think we've seen the markets react this week globally and now domestically with some serious concerns about how much longer this has got to play out and the impact it's going to have on investment and confidence.
So our conversations earlier have been things around jobs, wages, consumer confidence. Mm. This has a domino effect.
Correct. And I think that all of those three things you just mentioned are actually way more important than anything else in the political game in this state. Mm. Cast your mind back to 2017 when Colin Barnett got the boot, and comprehensively it was because people made a really easy connection with the financial performance of his government and their own personal financial circumstances, which were much, much worse for the great majority of people in the middle class and the lower middle class than I think most people sitting in this room appreciated at the time, certainly more than I appreciated at the time. As I say, go forward to March 2021, if people are feeling good about their job prospects, their mortgage, their household finances, they'll re-elect the McGowan government. If they're feeling really pessimistic about those things, they'll go looking for an alternative. Mm-hmm. Now, do I think that this means that Lisa Harvey will be Premier? If you're asking me right now today, I think the answer's probably no. Am I prepared to rule out the possibility? Absolutely not.
So looking at the electoral math, what they need, 12 seats to win. There's 11 seats held by less than a margin of 6%, 15 under 10%.
And even that, I think that the last election showed, even people sitting in this room who work in the Premier's office couldn't believe the swing that was on last time around. If it swung one way, tell me why it can't swing back the other way.
No.
There are very few rusted on political allegiances, especially where elections in Western Australia are won and lost, which is the northern suburbs corridor of Perth. That is where elections are won and lost in Western Australia. If you win the northern suburbs of Perth, then since the 1960s, it's been true that you win government.
Gemma, what's your reading of the coronavirus issue as well. What are you hearing and people you talk to around Perth?
Well,
and you've been on Talkback with Radio, Gareth this morning.
We have this morning, actually. Weirdly, there's a cluster of coronavirus infections in near my hometown in Italy where my father was born, which is really random. And I was talking to a friend from home just this morning, and he said it's very unusual to see people walking through the mountains with face masks on, but that's what's happening. And I can't disagree with anything that's been said in terms of it is the known, and the impact is completely unquantifiable, and it would be a braver woman than I to sit here and try and articulate that. But it's incredibly concerning.
We live in a much more interconnected, and the stats around SARS, and the point I want to make about coronavirus is it's not actually about the deadliness of the virus,
no,
which I agree is about as severe as sort of a severe flu. Mm. The point is the disruption that it's having on economic activity. And at the moment, the great engine of modern industry is China, and it is ground to a halt. Mm. Now, how quickly can it be cranked back up again? What are the flow-on effects to every single industry that relies on a manufactured component that comes out of a Chinese factory in a much more interconnected world and global economy than we saw back in 2002, 2003 with SARS? That, I think, is the great unknown. Maybe it will resolve quickly. My sense is that it will not resolve itself quickly, and we've got a long way to run on that.
Yeah.
Sarah-Jane, there are so many variables at the moment, aren't there? We've talked about the US election, we've touched on Brexit, now we've got coronavirus and other uncertainties.
Yep.
Does the market and does business and industry, have they factored this into their planning, or are they like us and they're just holding on and seeing where this goes?
Yeah, look, a lot of businesses do factor this in. Like, we live in a very volatile world and we are much more connected globally, so they do expect volatility to go from, you know, the US-China trade agreements, from Brexit. We see things happen globally and we react. Like, our market very much responds to the global market. So companies are very, very much more aware of that. And you talk to CEOs and chairmen, and they don't really follow the market share price every single day. Like, markets go up, markets go down. They're much more concerned about the fundamentals, the underlying fundamentals, and because they invest in projects that are long-term. So they're not worrying about what's happening tomorrow. They're worrying about, you know, the impact of the longer term when they're making these big investments. And I think that goes back to the point we've talked about with the election here coming up. Like, the business leaders that I'm speaking to, they want to see policy. They want to see stable policy. They want to see investment. They want to see, what the government can do for small business, because that is what is actually going to help drive the economy at the moment. And we talk about the resources sector, and that is such an outlier. Like, I mean, that's sitting up here. You know, we're waiting for some big projects to be signed off this year, and that's great, but that's not what is going to really give that consumer confidence back to the wider economy here.
Mm. I see Chris Rodwell from CCI is here, so I'm sure he's nodding with delight about the importance of small business. Are they going to be the bread and butter issues over the next 12 months? Is it going to come down to basically how the general public feel around their job security, their wages to pay the bill, make ends meet, and we touched on it around the job prospects, the outlook for their kids. Is that,
of course,
going to get down to those retail issues?
Yeah.
More than normal, Jemmy, you did say doesn't it always, but law and order normally takes a higher order. Is that going to take a back seat?
To me, they're two sides of the same coin. It's about that general feeling of safety and security.
Yeah.
The crime issue is really interesting. I spend a lot of time thinking about crime in Perth and Western Australia, because this is a safe place to live. If you watch the commercial television news bulletins, it bleeds, it leads. There is crime stories on top of the rundown every night. And if you're in the middle of them, they're really, really serious.
Yeah.
They are concentrated in about 5-6 different parts of the city. And I don't need to tell you what they are. You could guess off the top of your head. So there's a bit of a two-speed thing going on with crime in this city as well. It impacts disproportionately on poorer socioeconomic areas. And for those people who are living next to a meth lab or a drug dealer's house or with hoons in their street, it makes their life absolutely living hell. And if they were pretty grumpy that no one seems to be doing anything about it to fix it, I think they'd be entitled to. But it again factors into that general sense of well-being, that general sense of, is my life tracking better than it was 4 years ago, that's the last time I cast a ballot, or are things actually on the improve?
Can I just jump in there? Sarah-Jane and I were talking about this over lunch. I do write for the paper a bit and all that sort of stuff, but I've actually been a small business owner for 17 years. I've won a Telstra Business Award. I started a business in my lounge room, in my spare room of my house in 2003, and with no sort of great ambition to run the business that I now do. I just wanted my life to look differently. That's the context. But when the conversation around the economy in Western Australia always ignores small business. It's like a token pat on the head, you know, off you trot. But, you know, I employ 10 people. I've been doing that for, as I said, 17 years this June and July, rather. And I really resent the conversations that ignore this part of the sector. Make it easier for me to employ people. Don't tax my payroll. Make it easier and cheaper for me to employ people. I'll employ more people. And I know I'm not the only one, standing here. And this is not intended to be a political statement. It's a statement of 17 years in business. And I feel like, you know, the conversation we had, yes, the mining resources sector in this country and this state is incredibly important. But during the downturn, that industry was not firing. Who's employing people? I'm employing people. We're still growing. We're working. We service clients all over the world. My point is, make it easier for this part of the sector to grow and to thrive and to employ more people. That's, to my mind, been a huge missing link.
And we've touched on that a little bit throughout the course of the day.
Bit, yeah.
So in terms of those microeconomic reforms, you've said payroll tax.
Yeah
it's the same
what else
stuff
should
that
be on the menu?
Chris and his predecessors have been talking about for 20 years that hasn't been done because it's too hard.
We've got a number of politicians here in the room. What should be on the menu for them?
The answers are really simple in theory. They're very difficult in practical political reality.
You've got to replace the revenue, and I'm aware of that. But
you've got to manage the budget.
Totally.
I mean, everyone, is there anyone who seriously thinks that stamp duty is a good idea and that we shouldn't replace it with a land tax?
Yeah.
But try and be the government that actually implements that and convinces someone who currently doesn't pay $1,500 a year in land tax that it's in their interest that they do. Mm. I don't know what the solution to that issue is. I suspect it's probably something like a longer-term phase-in.
Well, it's got to be long-term.
When you sell a house, you can tick a box. You can say, either I'm paying my stamp duty up front or I'm now going to the new land tax system that applies on this
really
land forever, for here and a day. Yeah. But, you know, that's why it hasn't happened. If it was easy, it would have already been done by now.
Sarah Jane?
I think from the business community point of view, what I keep hearing from the small business is just more government support, really. They just, particularly around tech and startup, there's a lot of calls for innovation, like funding and funding from the government to help a lot of these startups get off the ground. And also, I think which business that domestically and nationally cry about continually, whether it's state or federal, is red tape and just the amount of red tape they've got to get through for any sort of investment.
Actually, just on that point, I spoke at a function with John Key, former Prime Minister of New Zealand, about 3 years ago, and his view was, and he said in front of 500 people in the room, and he said, when the Australian economy starts to slow down, you blokes better watch out because you are so over-regulated here, it's impossible to do business. You'd almost look anywhere else but Australia because of the red tape, and that's at a federal level and a state level.
The only other thing I'd add to the mix is that it seems to me to be a pretty good time to borrow money. Interest rates are incredibly low. Super funds are overflowing with cash looking to invest that money. If you can somehow connect low interest rates, surplus money looking for stable investments and long-term infrastructure needs, to me, and jobs, to me, now's the time to do it.
Good time to buy a house, apparently.
Well, until next month.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself. I have heard Gareth on the radio go on about this quite a bit, so I couldn't help. We've got a few minutes left as a panel, and I think we did promise at the start we'd jump around and dance around and cover a few issues, so I think we've delivered on that promise. Quite like that link, actually, in an election we're talking about promises. I've said to the panellists I'm going to put them on the spot for the last couple of minutes, and I want each of them to give me their one big prediction for 2020. And we might sort of hold them to account and measure them on that and see how we go in 12 months' time if Paula has us back. So why don't we start, Sarah Jane, with you. Your one big pick for 2020. What should we be looking out for?
That's really hard.
Yeah.
That's really hard. I'm glad you're going first.
I'm going to stay away from political predictions because I think
dangerous.
We saw what happened to commentators at the last federal election who all got it completely wrong. I think mine's probably more of an obvious observation to the room here is on the economy. I think we aren't going to see the recovery that the state government would like us to see this year in the lead up to the election. I think it's going to be another extremely tough year in the economy in the state, excluding resources, of course. And so I think that the pain on households isn't going to be alleviated. Mm. And I think that will be the number one issue at the election next year.
Thanks, Gareth.
You've got me, Taro. Tim Kelly will finish top three in the Brownlow.
Yeah. Sorry, who?
Tim Kelly will finish top three in the Brownlow medal.
Okay.
Of more substance, a big prediction. I think, well, this isn't really a prediction, it's more something to watch. I think that the US presidential election, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, will be far more unpredictable than people think.
Mm-hmm.
And if Americans were prepared to vote for a candidate who said that he would shoot someone in the street in Fifth Avenue and his votes would go up and he would grab by the...
Mm-hmm.
Then Bernie Sanders' history may not be quite as relevant as
Ooh,
some people think.
I could do
think.
A whole half hour on that with you. Let's do it next Monday.
Write it down. Write
next
it in the
notebook. Next Monday. Save it for on air. Save it for on air.
Gemma?
I have something of far less substance. I'm picking Collingwood for the flag. Mighty Magpies. Seriously. No, seriously. Oh, I'm a member.
So you had to kill the crowd.
No, seriously, yeah. I think a shift... I would like to see, this is not a prediction, this is I would like to see a more sensible discussion around climate and a more sensible, dare I say it, centrist. And by that I mean including people who might be still not there but wanting to be part of. I'd like to see it less polarised. I'd like to see it more rational and less toxic. But I would also like to see Collingwood win a flag.
Wonderful. I can't agree on that last point. I can't.
And therein, I will never be asked back. It's okay.
Yeah. A black mark. Panel, thank you very much. I think this has been a really enjoyable conversation. You certainly make it easy for a facilitator that I throw you a lead and off you go, and you run with it, and then I have to pull you in and then send you in another direction. So I think we have a heap of fun.
Thanks,
I hope
so
you've
much.
All enjoyed it. I hope you've found it insightful and learnt something and maybe some food for thought. And on that note, hand back to Paula.
Thank you.